To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Connor. How you doing, young man?
I'm doing all right, Earl.
So am I, man. I'm doing great. I got up and went outside, and you realize it. I guess it's still a dew. It can be the dew that's on the windows and of the cars that's outside, and what is that called? The condensation.
The condensation.
Yeah, and dew. and it's getting, and you know, and so you know. You know, it's only a matter of time. But I want to welcome my guest.
Winter is on its way. That's what you didn't say. Winter is here.
I guess I want to welcome my guest.
They keep saying, ooh, it's nice weather. We know what it's really going to be like.
none other than a legend in our city and probably in many parts of the state. Mr. Claiborne Benson, he is the founder and executive director of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society. Good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
I am here and very delighted to be so. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It is, I knew that our audience, one of the main reasons that I wanted to bring you in is because I know of your commitment and passion for history. And especially African American history. And you have dedicated your adult life to preserving that history, not only nationally, but even in our city. And so the more I was hearing these discussions and conversations about, you know, critical race theory, and we should do away with that history because that history paints or depicts, you know, our country in a manner that is not favorable to, you know, people's children. And they don't want their children to feel bad about the history of this nation. And then I hear, you know, Lieutenant Governor and candidate for United States Senate say that they found the history of this nation was not a good history, the founding of the country. And people push back at that and say, hey, he shouldn't be saying that. Before we get into all of what we'll be talking about in the great history lesson you're going to give us, do you think we should do away with the history of this nation?
Goodness, are you kidding me?
I know. There are people who believe that.
Well, there may be, but that they're getting the wrong history because among historians and the entire world believes that the democracy that the United States of America has come up with is genius, given to us by the founding fathers and George Washington and all of those people names that we can come up with, Jefferson. That is a country's marvel, the uniqueness that the United States government has come up with in terms of a government, Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, United States,
the Bill of Rights
that people have as citizens here in these United States is second to none. And so, no, I don't think we ought to part with that. I mean, if you ask that question, then they should say that Waukesha should just part with its history, because in this region, Waukesha is the regional capital for an Underground Railroad. Waukesha planned and manipulated all of the Underground Railroad activities coming through the state of Wisconsin. It's Waukesha. It's not Milwaukee. It's not Racine. It's Waukesha. So, no, we don't, and Waukesha don't want to get rid of its history because it's a model throughout the rest of the country. I mean, we asked the question, should Underground Railroad, and the Southerners said, we want our rights to exist. But it's Waukesha that says, after the Great Compromise of 1850, it's Waukesha that says we're going to violate that. We're going to tell the South that runaways can find safe haven coming through the state of Wisconsin. It's Waukesha. That's significant. And so to say we're not going to honor or do history, because it's American history and it's embedded in the fiber of this country, and that includes Waukesha.
You know, Claiborne, there are probably not a whole lot of people in Waukesha who even know what you just talked about.
It is. I mean, Waukesha was the regional capital for the Underground Railroad for this activity, and that included all southeastern Wisconsin. Not so much Milwaukee, but Racine, Walworth County, Kenosha, all of those little small towns that helped move African Americans through the state going to Canada. It's Waukesha. And this country was so upset with communities like Waukesha, but Waukesha's not the only one, but like Waukesha, that Henry Clay and John Calhoun met representing this country's Republicans and Whigs party to decide whether or not there is going to. And they said, stop expanding to the West, South, and the North. Stop helping runaway slaves make their way to Canada. After all, they said, it's in the United States Constitution that we should honor that. And it's Waukesha that said, even though that's passed 4 years later in 1854, they helped Joshua Glover make its way through Racine, Milwaukee, and then on its way to Canada. That's against the federal law, and Waukesha did it.
So, you know, Claiborne, it is. So that's how so many of these small towns, you see small settlements of African Americans in areas that are basically segregated because they came through
Waukesha.
Came to the state of Wisconsin. Yeah, and so people stopped in some of those towns and set up settlements.
I think that's a little exaggeration. I mean, people came for a whole host of reasons. Some invited, some left Milwaukee for reasons and settled in various areas. Some of them were made to feel welcome, and some were made not to feel welcome. So early on, 1920s, 1930s, African Americans were all the way throughout this state in various locations, small in number, but still nonetheless a lot of places. After the Civil War, many of the soldiers took with them a family or individuals to settle in all of these locations all over the state of Wisconsin. They even came to Waukesha. Joanne Williams, you know Joanne
yes.
Williams. Her ancestors were in Waukesha. The first Tuskegee Airmen lived in Waukesha. So he's African American. Yes, not only did Waukesha play an important role, and not only did African Americans live in various spots throughout the state of Wisconsin after the Civil War. We clustered mostly to the city of Milwaukee because Milwaukee had the industrial belt, and Milwaukee's the place where we were most recruited to live in those particular areas.
So before we get so far down the road, let's introduce you to the audience, people who don't know who Claiborne Benson is. Let's begin by letting people know who Claiborne Benson is and how you came to do the things you're doing.
So I'm originally born in Washington, D.C., and came here with my mother in 1960 and went to 20th Street Elementary School and went up through the Milwaukee public school system and graduated from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, adopted by Henry and Booby Moore. They own Moore's Barbershop and also Booby's Place.
You remember them well.
Yeah. And they sort of nurtured me and developed me. And so here I am. I worked as a news cameraman with WTMJ Television for some 35 years.
You must have been, if not the first black cameraman.
Second. I was the second. Kenny right. Bedford was the first, and he worked at Channel 6, and so that they needed to compete. They were always competing, so that they hired another one, and that other one was me. But I was the first at Channel 4, and was those there those golden years with John McCullough and a whole host of reporters and such.
You did that for at least 30 how many years?
36 years. Yeah, I worked there as a cameraman. And we did a whole host of stories. I mean, I'm talking about stories now, but I sort of had my own head, and I wanted to do stories about African-Americans. And so although I did do the conventional stories that aired on the station, also did my own stories.
Yeah, I remember many of those.
Mm-hmm. For example, during Thanksgiving, I would show that not every family had a turkey on their dining room table. During Christmas, I showed that not every family got Thanksgiving. I did a whole series of black unemployment series that aired. I traveled to Africa and Egypt and a whole host of countries outside of us. Looks like we're about to go into commercial break.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. My guest is Claiborne Benson. He is the founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society and proprietor. You can join us. We're going to have a great conversation, an in-depth conversation about black history, about Juneteenth Day, and a host of other things. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back. You can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789 in Texas. At that same number, my guest is none other than Claiborne Benson. He is the curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society. You know, Claiborne, there's so much history. We can't capture it all, but we're going to certainly take a bite out of it. So I was talking with some young kids last Friday at one of the high schools, and I was asking them about slavery and what they knew about the history of our people. And it was pretty amazing to me that they didn't know a whole lot. But I'm going to ask you, we're in Wisconsin. It may sound like a crazy thought, but was there any slavery in Wisconsin?
There was. There was slavery in Wisconsin. And part of the 1787 agreement passed in Congress that there should be no slavery anywhere in the Northwest Ordinance, meaning the territory of Michigan, the Lake Michigan, Wisconsin, some parts of Ohio, Indiana and Iowa, there was to be no slavery at all in those areas.
But was there slavery already going on before they enacted that law?
There was slavery before, and there's and Africans being brought from the continent of Africa down through Canada and to control the Louisiana Territory by the French, and ended up settling in the St. Louis area, but they made their way in the whole Louisiana patch. And so Wisconsin's attached to the Louisiana, and many of those enslaved people, Africans, made their way into Wisconsin. But there are many layers of enslavement that it took place here. That's the early, early stuff. There were Africans brought, or African Americans brought to the state of Wisconsin just to be enslaved. First as trappers and guides and frontiersmen, because this was a haven for trappers who wanted to get furs and such to sell throughout the rest of the world. But they were transporters. They were trading post operators. They were domestic workers. They were cooks. They did everything. But the largest of them were lead miners in the western part of the state. The western part of the state. Now, the two major military posts were Fort Brown, which was in the Green Bay area, and Prairie du Chien, Fort Crawford. Both of those military bases had enslaved people in those particular locations. And the commander, or second in command, was Jefferson Davis. Jefferson, you know that name. He's a Confederate president of the United States. A second lieutenant in Fort Crawford understood what the laws were, and he decided that if he were going to recruit more qualified officers to settle in Fort Crawford and to settle in this area, he needed to lift some of the rules. And the rules were there were to be no slaves in this area. He said that they could bring their valleys and their servants and their enslaved people with them, and thus they come. And so if the military says it's okay, the miners said, well, we can bring ours. The domestic people said, we can bring ours. Everybody began to bring enslaved people. Now, we're not talking thousands and thousands and thousands, but we are talking 600, 700, 800 people throughout the state in various locations at different times. Slavery did exist in the state of Wisconsin, and it was not
legalized.
It was not legalized. Now, if you could look at the Grant County census, and you can clearly see where there is enslaved people there, because it's marked in slavery people there. But if you look at the 1820s, 1830s, and 1840s, you can see how it evolved from being a enslaved person to Miss Johnson. The people gained a sense of respect for these people who lived among them that were indeed enslaved.
So how many decades was that allowed to take place?
It began to decline in the 1840s, 1850s. It began to, and
so we're talking less than half a century that went on.
Yes, and it's the abolitionists and it's the church that began to change that narrative. People began to say that this is a wrong thing and we don't want this to continue. And so the church began to shame the slave owners. And they were human beings who everybody liked and respected. They were a stable businessmen in the communities. But the lead mines were hard, dirty, mean, unhealthy work, and the white people did not want to do it during that early period of time. But lead mining did not go away, and white folks did involve themselves in the dirty work of going down ropes to below the surface, 50 feet, 100 feet to harvest lead. And that lead would service our military from the Civil War all the way to Vietnam. The lead from the lead mines in the western part of the state of Wisconsin brought a lot of money in, and it made bullets.
Right.
For the military, bullets.
So listen, we've got to go to a break. Our phone line's open as always at 844-967-2789. My guest is Claiborne Benson, curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society. You can join us. We'll be right back. Show as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is none other than Claiborne Benson. He is the curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society. And before we went to break, Claiborne, you know, the first half an hour you were talking about Waukesha's place in this history. And you were beginning to talk about the Underground Railroad. You've got some people that it's important. You think it's important for us to know about?
Yeah. So that Great Compromise of 1850 is the moment in which the South is saying we're not happy with the North and various communities in it, and we're going to compromise. And many of your listeners know history, and they know about the Great Compromise. They don't probably know how Wisconsin played a role in it, but Wisconsin plays a major role in that Great Compromise being voided, being seen as not important. And much discussion came in resolving their distrust for each other, that being the North and the South. And then the South is saying, it's written in the United States Constitution. That's a sacred law that enslaved people have to be returned to their proper owner. There are two things written in there, if I'm talking about the Constitution. One, the three-fourths concept, and two, the fugitive slave law. Those two things protected the South for having slavery in existence. And so, one, that they should never read. Two, that they are less than human. Three-fifths of a man. Yes, we can count their vote, but only in terms of white recipients financially. That's the three-fifths fits into all of that, has a lot of meaning. Runaway slaves, the fugitive slave law was quite simple. If a runaway makes their way from my plantation in the South and comes to Wisconsin, I have a right to retrieve them and take them back home. It's clearly written in the United States Constitution, and the South demanded that that the North honor that. And so they sat down together with the Great Compromise of 1850, Henry Clay and John Calhoun, representing the two parties, and they came up with the compromise. They signed it. Everybody's happy. And then here, Wisconsin violates it. Wisconsin say, and now I'm not going to tell you that Wisconsin is the only state that violated. I won't do that because I don't know that, number one, and I do know that other states didn't stop. But they did it at night. They did it when the soldiers were gone. They did it when they snuck and do it. They did it anyway. Wisconsin does it out loud. Excuse me. They do it in the daylight. They did it. Dun, 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 dun. Excuse me for getting excited about that. They see it south. Look at what we are doing. We are helping these people make their way to Canada in front of your face. So, every newspaper in the entire United States is publishing it. They do it in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and many of the abolitionists come from Waukesha to help make it happen. Now, let me say one other thing. If you ask historians today, they'd say there were 5,000 abolitionists that broke him out of jail. That's not true. But that's how they embellish
you. You mean Joshua Glover?
Joshua Glover.
Right.
They breaking him out of jail. 5,000. That's not true.
So
is true is 500. But nonetheless, they're so excited about this moment in time that they did.
So two questions.
Yes, sir.
Why Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, Illinois, did any of them?
Yeah, they did it.
All of them.
They snuck and did it.
Okay.
They snuck in. You're talking about Midwest states.
Right.
They did it in the East Coast, too. Boston and not so much New York, but they did it in the East as well as they did it in the Midwest.
Okay.
But it's Wisconsin that does it publicly. It's Wisconsin that broadcasts the entire. 500 people that actually did it, and they made sure the entire world knew that they were doing it.
So who was Joshua Glover that he had to be, that they were looking to free him?
Well, let's say the first runaway is Caroline Qualls. Now, I'm not going to say Caroline Qualls is the first. I'm saying she's the first known. I'd suggest that there were many more others, many. But Caroline Qualls is seen to be the first well-known abolitionist that break. She comes from St. Louis, Missouri. Her father is an enslaved person. She's 16 years old, long, pretty hair, very attractive young lady, and mulatto. Her father is a white slave owner, and her mother is an enslaved person. His father says to her, it's time for you to be a slave. It's time for you to stop playing with white kids and work the fields like everybody else. You're a grown young woman, and we want you to stay in your place. She didn't like that, and so she put on some clothes and passed for white, got on a riverboat, and came to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by way of Illinois. And she appears in Milwaukee, and she's walking around trying to find a place to hide. And a man by the name of Robert Tidbull. Tidbull is a barber, and he wants to help this young woman out. He hides her out in his house. And in the process, he hears about. There is a reward of $300 for her capture.
Which is a lot of money back then.
Man, that was a huge piece of money. And so he then gets the app. Now, they're searching every house, every closet, every basement, abolitionists from, not abolitionists, but slave catchers from all over the country are here to capture her and to return her. And nobody finds her because abolitionists find her first in Tidbull's house and then takes her to a general store. They hide her in out in front of everybody in a pig barrel, a huge pig barrel where pig head and chitlins and all that stuff is
wow.
With vinegar, and she is submerged under that with a straw of some sort so she can breathe, but she's hiding in clear view of everybody, and thus she stays there for a period of time and then makes her way to Wauwatosa, and then from Wauwatosa into Waukesha, where she hides out in Pewaukee, And she hides out with a family for a period of time until she's discovered. And abolitionists from Waukesha come and pick her up and take her down to trying to think of the name of the community, and hides her out in the community, Warworth County. Anyway, I'm going to think about it before I'm having a senior moment here. And then they raise $11. Burlington, Wisconsin is where she's hid out. She hits out in Burlington. They raise $11 going door to door, walking the streets, and they take the $11. And they most runaways make their way by boat. She goes by wagon from small town to small town, and goes to various abolitionist hotbeds or communities as they make their way to Canada. And she still goes to a place called Sandwich, Canada, and she remained there, got married, and had two children, and became actively involved in the church in Sandwich, Canada.
So now Joshua Glover.
So Joshua Glover comes in 54, but Joshua Glover comes after the Great Compromise of 1850. And we talked about that. And Joshua Glover comes here, and Joshua Glover is arrested. I'm sort of holding this picture up. Joshua Glover is arrested in Racine, Wisconsin. Someone tells on him. He comes here and he finds a job, and then he is arrested.
Yeah, young man.
He is. That's an interesting question, because I'd say he's late 20s.
Yeah, sure.
30s, and he is. He is arrested by the U.S. Marshal because someone tells on him. His owner comes from St. Louis and finds him. They put him in jail as a holding pen because he's going to be returned back to St. Louis with his owner and an abolitionist group of 500 people. Many of them from Waukesha go and break him out of jail. Sherman Booth is sort of the organizer of this. Just imagine like Paul Revere running from location to location. Here, Joshua Glover is in town. We must rescue him. We must rescue him. And Booth goes and raises 500 or more people to break him out of jail. And they use the beam from the Cathedral Church at Cathedral Square. That's where the jail and the courthouse is. They use this beam and they knock the door down and they get him out of jail. Now, the U.S. Marshal's there, the Milwaukee County Sheriff is there, but none of them are able to stop Glover from being
so. So, what's amazing to me, Claiborne, is that the amount of energy and effort and manpower that they would put into bringing back one slave.
Yes.
I mean, to me, that's mind-boggling.
But then you need to ask the question, what is the motivation of the abolitionists? Because the abolitionists are quite serious about fighting slavery.
So was it their religious tenet?
Some of it was religious. I've come up with four reasons why the abolitionists were so intense on fighting against enslavement. And I would paraphrase that by saying that many of them, even before they leave Europe to come to the United States and specifically Wisconsin, they knew that they were going to be an abolitionist in some form, either directly or indirectly. The indirectly people had as much to do as the direct people. You may have heard of Mr. Goodrich and others because they actually own the buildings and such, but it's the indirectly people who supported Mr. Goodrich. So example would be political. That was a reason because many of them, the Republican Party had on its platform policy, they're against enslavement. Free soilists, economically, they didn't like the fact that they competed against the Southerners,
right,
who and all they had was their cousins and next door neighbors to harvest their crop, free soilists, political, religious, and many of their ancestors themselves were enslaved in Europe, and not their mothers and fathers,
right,
but their grandparents who passed down the message: we want nothing to do with enslavement, and we want you to stop this, and so that they went out of their way to stop slavery going on.
You know what would be tragic, Claiborne, is as we you start unpacking this, is if somehow this history was did away with. I mean, I know a little bit. I thought I knew, but in depth, the history of this is the history of this country.
Yeah.
And the fact that people don't want to know about it is really shameful. And maybe after today, you know, when people get some of what it is, a thirst for what you're bringing to the table, they themselves would dig a little bit deeper.
Sure.
Because it is all of our history.
Mmm. And their history.
Yeah, history. All right, got to go to a break.
Sure.
844-967-2789. My guest is Claiborne Benson. He is the curator and founder of America's Black, Wisconsin's Black Holocaust Museum.
Wisconsin Black
Historical Society.
That's right.
Yeah, I was doing fine. Yeah, I was doing fine up until I had it on automatic pilot. All right, got to go to a break. We'll be right back.
To that agreement in the first place.
Okay.
Because, I mean, yeah, pretty much. Because it's, to my knowledge of history, that was one of the main drivers behind the Civil War that happened a couple of decades following Three-Fifths Compromise. I mean, that plus states' rights and
okay, hold the thought because we're getting ready to go back, and we'll make sure late after right. we deal with this part of it.
We'll
come back to it.
Right.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is Claiborne Benson, the curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society. And we're talking about, you know, history. We're talking about American history, and it has frustrated me to no end to hear people talk about doing away with this history, and so I asked him if he would come in and do an in-depth discussion on this history of what happened in this state, and especially there are people who think now, with Wisconsin being one of the most segregated states in all the nation, this is one of the most racist states in the entire nation. Claiborne has been pointing out that the history of the nation, of the state, certainly points to it being one of the most open to supporting, people escaping from slavery. And so we wanted to talk now, Claiborne, you wanted to talk about Thomas Jefferson.
And so before we talk about Thomas Jefferson, what's the name of the newspaper here in Waukesha? What is the name of the newspaper?
I think it's called Freeman.
That's right. Freeman.
Yeah.
That's the point that I wanted to raise to you, that the newspaper's name is Freeman. And that's for a reason. The reason is they viewed people as being free. Freedmen, freed. And so that the abolitionists and that whole spirit about the newspaper was named. And now that's a dying art. And the newspaper obviously has less publications than it had in previous years. But clearly, that was the title of the city of Walker.
That's important to know. It's free. It is important to know.
And I have a manuscript of one of the founders of Waukesha who talks about his abolitionist activities, both with the Joshua Glover thing and in the city of Waukesha, and how important it was to maintain the newspaper with the freedmen title and the philosophy that the citizens in Waukesha talked about. So now we're going to go to Thomas Jefferson. And so most folks don't know that the Jefferson family lived in, John Jefferson lived in Wisconsin, lived in Madison. Beverly Jefferson lived in Madison. Beverly Jefferson was a successful businessman. He owned like three hotels, a stagecoach, a stable where he had cabs running around from.
A wealthy man.
A man of means.
Yeah.
And his father lived in Washington, and they're buried in Madison. Today, they're buried there. But Thomas Jefferson, in the Civil War, becomes enlists as a as an officer and rises to the rank of full bird colonel in the 8th Wisconsin. John Jefferson, I'm sorry, not Thomas Jefferson.
His father.
Thomas Jefferson is his father. John Jefferson is his grandson, okay, who lives in Wisconsin. And John Jefferson becomes a full-blood colonel in charge of the 8th Wisconsin, the old Eagle Battalion or Brigade in Wisconsin. And so thus, he's active in the Tennessee-Vicksburg siege. He is very, very, I can't even emphasize how important he is to Ulysses Grant as one of his lieutenants controlling the siege around Vicksburg. Because cutting the South off from their supplies from the West was everything. And John Jefferson, who's a commander of the 8th Wisconsin, does that. And so he eventually dies in Tennessee and is buried. But it's John Jefferson that commands the 8th Wisconsin. Now, most people have heard about the Eagle Battalion and the 8th Wisconsin, but they don't know John Jefferson. Now, and John Jefferson is a light-skinned young man. He is, in some cases, he was viewed as passing, but there were many people who knew that he was a descendant of Thomas Jefferson, and that he was a man of color.
So were all of Thomas Jefferson's?
No, not all of them. Just
free.
Just one wing of them settled in the Madison area. They like Madison's, the name of Madison. They like President Madison.
Yeah.
So that's why they settled in.
I'm saying the blacks' offspring.
That's right.
Of his, they weren't all freed.
Thomas Jefferson freed them as part of his will.
Yeah.
He did not free Sally Hemings.
Okay.
He did free his children, and they moved to Ohio right after their freed period, and then eventually moved to Madison.
So area. Sally Hemings was the mother of those slaves.
That's right.
Of those children.
Yes. Yes, they were.
And he didn't free her.
He did not free her. He did not. Okay. She remained, although she wasn't confined to the plantation, she had the freedom to move about as she chose to, and she had resources to live in Virginia thereafter. Charlottesville, I believe she had an apartment and such, but she lived the remainder of her life away from the plantation itself. Yes, but she was still enslaved.
You know, we've got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open, as always, at 844-967-2789. I trust you are enjoying, as much as I am, this history that we are receiving from none other than Claiborne Benson, who's the curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society. You know, it is really important in the midst of all of what we're hearing right now. that we understand the value of this information. We'll be right back. Been told it. Roll over, baby.